Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today, our topic is the 10 Common Objections to Capitalism with Dr. Timothy Terrell. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm really happy that you could make it with us today. So let me just tell everyone that Dr. Terrell is a professor of economics at Wofford College in South Carolina. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Good, good. And he specializes in environmental and ethical issues. So, you know, I listened to you give a lecture yesterday, Tim, on these 10 common objections to capitalism. I was very impressed. First, let's talk about a definition of what is capitalism.
I would really like to have my word back, the word capitalism, from some of the leftists and some of those that are anti-market. I think that capitalism is too commonly associated with something that is just generally what businesses want. And we all know that businesses sometimes will seek a competitive advantage by using the government. Mm-hmm. They will try to attain some kind of monopoly power.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not at all what I mean by capitalism. Mm-hmm. By capitalism, I refer to a free market, a market in which people are free to enter or leave a market anytime. They can provide a service if they like without having to satisfy licensure requirements. And a market in which people are free to purchase what they want without having the government step in to the transaction and ban it or put certain conditions on it.
Well, we're going to talk about the slivers of capitalism, as you call it, that we have. But I really like this example that you gave from Roderick Long about calling capitalism what we see today is like calling something else something else. Why don't you give us that example?
Yes, well, Dr. Long says, suppose I invent this word, Zaxxonbacks. And he says, it's a metallic sphere like the Washington Monument. And then he goes on to say, well...
Which isn't round sphere.
Of course. And so he says, well, a Zaxxonback would be better if it were rounder and shinier and not tall and pointy.
Hmm.
So if I'm defending capitalism here, I'm not defending whatever Western industrial society has come up with.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we have in the United States is not a truly free market. And so if I have a problem with the market in the United States or with something in the United States, it's not necessarily a problem with capitalism. It's the intervention that we have into our system that is producing so many of the problems that people are complaining about.
We really should discuss at some point or along the way what term really better depicts this. I've heard the term mercantilism being used,
yes.
Interventionism,
yes.
Being used.
Tom DiLorenzo mentions fascialism, a kind of
mm-hmm.
combination between fascism and socialism, and I believe Ron Paul uses the word corporatism.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of these words could be very descriptive.
Yeah, I've heard crony capitalism,
yes.
You know, and things of that nature. I particularly am focused on this term interventionism because being a small business owner, you know, I find myself very much limited as to what kind of intervention I can elicit from the government.
Yes.
You know, but larger businesses, they definitely can and do use resources to do that for their advantage.
They certainly do.
Yeah. So we're going to start with this first of the 10 common objections to capitalism, that capitalism exploits the poor. I'm only going to let you talk for about 30 seconds, so go ahead.
That's fine. You know, one of my favorite books by Ludwig von Mises is his little book, Economic Policy. And there's a wonderful section in this book where he discusses the tremendous advantages for the poor that capitalism has produced. He says, you know, the fact that we are surviving today in this with the Industrial Revolution having taken place is evidence of its success.
Okay, so we're going to pick up on that particular thread when we come back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Timothy Terrell, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Timothy Terrell. We're talking about the 10 common objections to capitalism, and we're discussing number one, capitalism exploits the poor. Please, Tim, go ahead.
Yes, well, one of the misconceptions, I think, about capitalism is that the objections initially during the Industrial Revolution came from the workers themselves. And, in fact, it was not the workers who came up with these criticisms of capitalism. The gentry, the nobility, the landed aristocracy were blaming capitalism for the fact that they had to pay higher wages to their agricultural workers. They didn't like the fact that workers were going off to the city and earning higher wages in the factories. So they managed to come up with this tremendous misconception in the popular mind about how terrible the factory situation was.
Well, for the people that were working in the factories, that was actually an improvement in their survival rates. As you started to mention in the last segment, the population now was 10 times greater than before the age of capitalism.
That's right. In fact, if you look at the time from about 1760 to about 1830, the population of England doubled. And the reason for this, of course, is that hundreds of thousands of children who would have died in preceding times were now surviving.
Mm-hmm.
Infant mortality rates were dropping.
Yes, because there was about, about a 1 in 10 infant mortality rate?
It was tremendous. I wouldn't be surprised if it were higher. Yeah. I don't have the statistic in front of me.
Well, I love this point you made that just because you're listening to this or just because you may be arguing with this particular point, you are the product of capitalism.
Most likely, yes.
That's very interesting. So, you know, how about the assumption that the children would have been in school if only we could have gotten capitalism to stop exploiting them in the factories and so on?
This is one of those things that Mises is so good on, and he says, you know, these children would not have been in comfortable nurseries. They would not have been in schools. They would have been starving. They would have been dying. And you look today at so-called developing countries where children, if they are working at a young age, what's the alternative to working? It's either a life of crime or some less desirable work than what they have in the factories, prostitution or crime on the streets or some other kind of less beneficial existence for them.
What about the argument that industrialization destroyed the agrarian culture? It's destroying our culture in some way.
Well, if you look at the conditions of life in an agricultural society, the working conditions, they are worse even in the United States today. The accident rates are higher, the wages are lower, and if you want to see improvements in someone's standard of living, then moving toward industrialization tends to produce those things we like to see.
Mm-hmm. So you made this interesting comment that agricultural labor, because it pays less and is more dangerous than industrial labor, are we supposed to preserve a zoo?
Right. And sometimes we look at developing countries and we say, well, isn't this terrible that their culture is dying and being replaced by this consumerist Western culture? But what do the people in that culture really want? Do they want to be to see lower death rates for their children? Do they want to have longer life expectancies? Do they want to be able to travel and communicate with their relatives? Because all of those things are products of a capitalistic system.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we leave this particular objection that capitalism exploits the poor, I want to go back to this infant mortality thing that we just touched on for a minute. We don't have the exact statistic on that, but you did mention a very interesting stat on average life expectancy from the Roman Empire through now.
Yes. Art Cardin mentions in an article recently that at the height of the Roman Empire, the life expectancy was about 24.
Wow.
And at the end of the 15th century, he says, in Britain, it was about 30. It was about 45 in the United States at the beginning of the 20th century.
In the beginning of the 20th century?
At the beginning of the 20th century. Very high infant mortality rates. I mean, if you survived childhood, you were probably okay.
Mm-hmm.
But there were such high death rates, communicable diseases and so forth, that would kill people before the age of five.
Mm.
And then today, of course, we're pushing 80 for people born alive in the United States.
Okay, so let's move on to the second big objection, that capitalism is unjust. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's the idea of justice is a concept that anti-market critics will manipulate to their advantage. They will say, well, this is what ought to be. We ought to see this kind of wealth distribution in society. And yet nature is stingy with resources. It requires our ingenuity as human beings to make something out of this world in which we live.
It's difficult to get things out of the ground.
It certainly is. Nature's not bountiful, as Mises says in another book of his called The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality.
Yeah, you had a quote from that?
Yes, he says that nature has populated the world with animals and plants to whom the impulse to destroy human life and welfare is inwrought. It's part of nature to destroy our existence. And we don't have an open-handed nature. We have to consider not a sort of manna from heaven source for our well-being that then has to be distributed properly.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible, I think, to separate the creation of resources from the ownership of those resources.
I like this part of that particular quote from Mises, that there's a delusion that nature has endowed a certain amount of stuff, and
yes,
the chief problem is how to allocate it.
Right.
And that's a very interesting and telling thing, because if that mentality gets legs, people think, well, it's just a process of us figuring out how to allocate it, not
that's
how
right.
to get it.
As though these resources create themselves.
Right. And so we have to go to that next level of logic. How do we get it?
Correct.
You know, that's the important thing on that. So I love this point that you made. It is the skill with which we get from nature that brings us stuff.
Yes.
And so talk about wealth distribution for a minute. This directly ties to that.
Yes. The concept of justice that anti-market advocates will use says, well, we have a certain amount of things that have been created, and it's almost as though they ignore the property rights over these things, that if I create it, then somehow it's up to the state then to distribute that thing that I've made to whoever needs it most,
mm-hmm.
needs it in their minds, by their definition of justice. There's a lot of nonsense on this. The World Council of Churches back in the 1940s said that justice demands that the inhabitants of Asia and Africa should have the benefits of more machine production. But we don't have a certain quantity of machines that then have to be distributed to the various nations.
Mm-hmm.
We have this idea that the capitalistic nations of the world were unjust in refusing to give to these other nations the products of their labor, the products of their development.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, so let's move on to the third objection, that capitalism doesn't make us happy.
Yes. There's this concept of capitalism creating a neurotic kind of society. Everybody's on Prozac. Everybody's anxious. How am I going to satisfy my employer? Nobody's working for themselves. Everyone is unhappy to the point of suicide. And yet, this is not the fault of capitalism. We might find people who have worked very hard and have yet not found happiness. And yet, if you talk to someone who is in a developing nation, a poor nation, and you say, what is it that you want?
Let's go to Ethiopia, for example.
Yes. They're not concerned with, you don't find Ethiopians spending billions of dollars on diet products and slimming products.
They're not combating obesity.
No. Right. That's not their problem. It's our problem in the United States is different.
Right. They have a more serious problem called starvation.
Yes, exactly. Right. That is their problem. And a capitalistic society is not going to solve all of our difficulties with anxiety and depression and so forth. But it's certainly not going to help someone be happy if they have to confront high infant mortality rates, shorter life expectancies, the inability to travel. If you give someone a more varied diet, a more consistent diet, that's helpful to them by almost any standard.
And yet in a more capitalistic society, people can make mistakes and do make mistakes.
Certainly they do. And I think it's a mistake to say...
I think
they
would make a mistake in any kind of society.
Certainly, certainly.
So
I think it's a mistake to say that the market has somehow failed if we don't live an anxiety-free, depression-free life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we do struggle with that in capitalistic societies, but I think people are dealing with very serious and more severe problems in non-capitalistic societies.
Right. So you mentioned also that intervention makes a mess out of a better life, and it makes it a worse life. Please explain that a little bit more.
Intervention will take a society in which people will do what they like and turn it into a society in which they're told, you will do certain things because we think that this is appropriate for you.
Or you can't do certain
exactly.
things.
Prohibition right. becomes the norm.
Right. So, well, we're going to be coming into a break, folks, and so we're going to just introduce the next of these 10 most common objections to capitalism, that capitalism doesn't account for non-material goals, and which is an intriguing title for this particular one. We'll get into that right after the break. So please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Timothy Terrell. And this is a very fascinating conversation. We'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us, folks. Welcome back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm talking with Dr. Timothy Terrell. The fourth most common objection to capitalism that you list here, Tim, is capitalism doesn't account for non-material goals. What does this mean, non-material goals?
Well, there are a number of things that we would like to see in a society. Faith, justice, love, compassion, sympathy, cooperation. And so a lot of critics of a capitalistic society will say, well, yes, society produces a lot of material goods, but it's morally bad because it does not consider these non-material goals that people might have. It's only concerned with more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's a valid criticism. For one thing, in order to accomplish these non-material goals, in order to show love to my neighbor, to be sympathetic, to have justice in society, I have to have resources, access to physical resources. So for one thing, if capitalism is good at providing physical resources to people, I think that that's perfectly consistent with these non-material goals that people have.
How does this twist the term economics?
Yes, there's a perversion of that term economic. Economics is about how we use resources of all kinds to accomplish our goals.
Now, I want to stop you right there because I wrote this down yesterday, and I have to say, and I'd love all our listeners to write this down because I thought this was the most succinct and best comprehensive definition of economics that I've ever heard, and so I'm going to read it again.
Sure.
If you don't mind, you can correct me if I happen to get a word
incorrectly.
But economics is about how we use resources to accomplish a goal. And why I like that particular thing so much is that I had always been working with two definitions of economics. One was the allocation of scarce resources, which is stuff part of the
yes.
equation, and the human choice of whether or not we're going to cooperate in harmony with each other or not.
Right.
And what I like about this particular definition is that it really melds the two together. It's about how we use the resources to accomplish a goal. How includes are we going to cooperate in harmony or not?
Yes.
And so that's very, very, very important.
And those goals don't have to be accumulating a larger house or more cars in the driveway. Mm-hmm. That can be a goal, but Mother Teresa had goals. Her mm-hmm. goal was mm-hmm. to see people in Calcutta treated well and cared for. Mm-hmm. That's no less an economic goal mm-hmm. than accumulating some kind of stuff.
You also made this very extraordinary statement that faith requires human action.
Yes.
Please discuss that a little
bit. So economics is a subset of a realm called praxeology, which is Mises' term for the study of human action. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about any kind of action, the action of a pastor, the action of a philanthropist, this is economic behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this is separate from moral behavior.
It's the realm of economics. I like to use the analogy that we are all economic beings.
Yes.
That saying you don't understand economics is like a fish not understanding water,
right.
A bird not understanding air, because we move through life in an economic world. We live in a realm of what we could call economics, and that our spiritual life, the development of our spiritual life, actually requires access to material things. How are we going to get to there?
Yes.
From here to there.
If you have a goal of feeding the hungry or clothing the naked or housing the homeless, helping the sick, all of those things can be done better with access to physical resources.
Mm-hmm. That's really terrific. So, all right, let's leave this behind. Let's go to the fifth most common objection to capitalism. Capitalism is aesthetically obnoxious and environmentally irresponsible. So this is loaded. There's a lot on this one.
There's so much here. And, you know, I keep hearing these objections to capitalism from students and others that I talk to. And, of course, the modern problem with the Gulf oil spill, people don't recognize the role that anti-capitalistic policy had in perpetuating that kind of tragedy,
mm-hmm.
or other kinds of environmental problems that we see.
Well, let's before we go on to the BP thing, let's talk about this from a more broad kind of perspective. You asked the question, can anyone just leave their employment?
Yes.
And then you ask the question, can anyone leave their tax jurisdiction?
Yes.
And so please discuss those.
One of the problems that I see in the anti-capitalistic argument is that I often hear that people are oppressed by their insurance company or they're oppressed by their employer. Well, I had a dispute with my auto insurance company a while back about a claim, but I didn't worry that my insurance company was going to put me in jail or kill me. I can move out of one provider to another provider services in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But leaving a political jurisdiction that I find tyrannical will be much, much more difficult for me. We see a dramatically higher level of tyranny among large political jurisdictions.
Very good. Well, we're going to be coming into our next break, and next after this we'll have our long segment. So folks, please stay with us. We're talking with Dr. Timothy Terrell on the 10 common objections to capitalism. This is very fascinating. You don't want to miss what's coming up. Please stay with us. And we're back. So, Tim, let me ask you this follow-up question. Was the BP disaster, was that a failure of capitalism?
I don't think so at all. Many people will point to this as an example of a rapacious industry that doesn't care about the environment. I think that's far from the truth. If you look at the actual circumstances of that oil spill, we find that there are so many government interventions that encouraged that kind of risk-taking behavior on the part of a company like BP.
Mm-hmm.
The government passed laws that gave oil companies incentives to drill farther offshore,
mm-hmm.
where the risk is necessarily far greater.
They prohibited them from drilling closer to shore where they wanted to.
Well, in the eastern part of the Gulf, there's a government ban on drilling. So if you constrain the area in which they can drill in shallow water, they're going to be incentivized to move further offshore in areas where they can drill.
And they capped the risk also at $75 million.
Yes, after the Exxon Valdez, they capped the risk at $75 million, and that can be waived in certain cases, but it certainly reduces the care that a company will take to avoid risk.
And the companies are not really incentivized to go and get external insurance because that basically satisfies the government's requirements.
Correct. And we see similar things in other industries, like the nuclear power generation is also, they have a risk cap. I'm not particularly concerned about the risk of nuclear power, but whenever a government capping a risk, that's going to reduce the care that the company will take.
Mm-hmm. So talk about this concept that you mentioned, neglected development. What does that mean?
Yes. Well, I had an associate of mine who took some students on a tour of the coastal Atlantic states. And he said, well, the market has produced this aesthetically obnoxious development in coastal areas. He says that the asphalt contractors and the burger merchants have just taken over. We get strip malls and big box stores, and the idea among those who hold to this anti-capitalistic mentality is that we need the government to control development.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like environmental amenities. Mm-hmm. I like uncrowded beaches. I like marshes. I enjoy going out into the open spaces of the world and enjoying myself, but it's not a solution to those problems.
Mm-hmm.
Of
you also like a burger when you want one.
Well, I sure do. I like those things, and mm-hmm. I want access to them.
Mm-hmm.
But people seem to think that urban sprawl is entirely a market phenomenon.
Well, what are the alternatives for people?
Well, if you look at the alternative to a market-oriented decision about what to do with resources, well, government ends up restricting those resources, access to those resources, so fewer people can enjoy those environmental amenities. We end up with an elitist access to the resort regions. Either that, or we end up with prices for access that are far below what the market would charge, and therefore they're overcrowded.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a combination of either overcrowded or underused natural resources. Neither is optimal.
Discuss a little bit more this idea you just mentioned about concealed elitism. What does that mean?
Yes. If the government's going to make decisions about who gets access, it's necessarily going to be a politically determined access. So rather than the highest value users getting to enjoy the environmental amenities, whoever's got the political pull ends up with access. This is not ideal.
Mm-hmm.
We have government deciding who gets what.
And so you can look at this by just looking who pays for the roads and sewers to the new, more exclusive developments.
Well, that was another point I made yesterday, that if you want to understand urban sprawl, understand that the costs of development are largely being subsidized by governments,
mm-hmm.
extending
which
the roads.
The general people.
Yes,
that's
of
right.
Course.
So that's the concealed elitism part of the equation. So what's the real danger of having government land, government in charge of this more exclusive land use?
I think that if you have government trying to plan resources and land use or any other kind of resource, it's going to end up being used in a way that is not producing the most benefit for society. You certainly have different ideas about how land should be used. Whose ideas then will be acted upon?
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you go to political determination of land use, then we end up with a situation in which there's less access except for those who are politically favored.
And so, as you mentioned, the real danger is handing over land to people who have elections to win rather than money to make.
Yes, my colleague argued that it's a terrible thing for land use to be driven by profit. Well, I would say it's a terrible thing for land use to be driven by who has an election to win. Politicians have a very short time horizon. They just want to win the next election.
Okay, here comes number six. Corporate scandals prove that capitalism doesn't work.
Well, this is one of the ones that I hear so often, and it's groundless, but it keeps coming up, so we ought to deal with it. There's nothing about capitalism that endorses fraud. Nothing about capitalism endorses unethical business practices. And in fact, if you look at what happens to these companies after a scandal is discovered, the companies usually go bankrupt, or at least the market discounts the value of their stock. The company is effectively punished by the market mm-hmm. for this kind of behavior.
Yeah, the market actually cleanses the behavior.
Yes, there's a constant purging of this kind of defrauding behavior. But then if you look at what...
And, you know, I'd like to interject here is, again, as a small business owner, that's because the market requires the trust of people.
Yes.
And so if that trust is violated, then those that really want to continue to be in the market have an enormous incentive to get that crap out of here.
Right. That's right. And if it's a bad idea, if you want a good reputation as a company, it's a bad idea to try to defraud your customers. They simply won't come back. They'll badmouth you to anyone else who might be a customer.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad for business to be a fraudulent provider of goods and services.
So we don't have business cycles due to different levels of greed?
No, I confront this with students very often. They'll look at the business cycle, the recent crisis, and they'll say, well, this is because bankers got greedy.
Well, they're always greedy.
Well, I tend to assume so, yes. There's sort of a baseline level of greed.
Yeah.
And
like fire, it can be used.
That's correct. It can be turned toward beneficial purposes. But normally the market puts constraints on that greed rather than seeking my own goals.
Or the government intervention fuels it.
Yes, it does. In fact, if you look at Tom Wood's book, Meltdown, which I'm always referring to students,
mm-hmm.
he points out several of the government intervention, features of government intervention that contributed to this crisis by removing those constraints on that behavior.
I want to interject for listeners that they can go to our Radio Free Market archives at radiofreemarket.com, and you will find an interview that we did with Dr. Tom Woods on his book, Meltdown. And it is available for free download, and I do recommend that you listen to it, because it is an excellent summary of this particular point. Okay, so let's move on, actually, to the next particular objection, and it's my absolute favorite, that meaning I despair when I hear it, but I hear it so often that capitalism is inherently racist and sexist. What's wrong with this?
Well, there's a misconception, I think, here about episodes of American history like our period of segregation. If you look at the incentives that the market creates, employers have an incentive, financial incentive, to hire on the basis of ability without
mm-hmm.
regard to race.
Mm-hmm.
Customers have an incentive to take a good deal where they can find it, no matter what the race of the person selling it.
Well, of course, because customers are looking for the lowest price possible.
Of course.
They want the best value for the lowest price.
And furthermore, you find that some of the battles against segregation were launched by businesses themselves. They realized that segregation was bad for their profits.
Because segregation costs the bottom line.
Of course it does.
So tell us about one of these stories. You mentioned something of private transit companies down in Florida.
There's a couple of good things that have come out
tell
lately.
Tell us that story in some detail, if you would.
Yes. Jeff Jacoby and George Leaf have done some good work on this, and they have pointed out, also Jennifer Roback, I should mention, in the Journal of Economic History, have pointed out that private transit companies were fighting segregation laws or would simply ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
And governments were constantly trying to press these companies into following their regulations.
So the governments were trying to enforce the bus companies to segregate themselves.
Yes.
And but this was so bad for businesses that the bus companies were actually resisting this.
Right. And if you look at for example, in 1904, Houston's streetcar company complained to the city government that they were being required to haul around a good deal of empty space that otherwise could have been occupied by African Americans. It was not being made available to both races, so they were losing money.
Did this happen elsewhere in the South?
It sure did. I mean, if you look at Jacksonville, Florida, in 1901, there was an ordinance that required black passengers to be segregated. It was not enforced until about 1905, and so the transit companies went on with integrated travel until the state legislature passed a law saying that you have to segregate.
So the local governments said they had to. The local businesses ignored the laws.
Yes.
And then the state government stepped in and said, you're not going to ignore this law.
Precisely, yes.
And in Amazing.
Fact, it was so obvious that the transit companies were opposed to segregation that when a group of black citizens were challenging the law in court, their attorney said, well, I just want to reassure the court that we are not in cahoots with the railroad lines in Jacksonville. There was such a harmony of interests between the anti-segregationist groups of African Americans and the business owners who did not want to lose profits that they were almost indistinguishable to the courts.
So segregation is really a product of governments, not markets.
I would say so, yes.
You made this comment also that... I didn't quite write it down exactly. Something about stop the competition, government.
Yes, if you look at some of the motivating factors behind segregation, you find that it's anti-competitive at its root. And often the labor unions and others would try to ban membership by minority groups because they did not want the competition.
Mm-hmm.
Apartheid in South Africa began partly because white citizens did not want the competition from black citizens for certain types of jobs.
Let's move on to the next one because this number 8 is fairly sophisticated, and I want to give you a couple of minutes to get into this one, that capitalism is prone to bubbles and panics.
Yes, there's so much good literature on this now, and I'd already mentioned Tom Wood's book, Meltdown, and there's so much that shows that when we have a recession, if you look at the government intervention through lower interest rates, artificially lower interest rates by the Fed, and if you look at regulation in this most recent crisis, regulation by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, regulations like the Community Reinvestment Act. These contributed to our crisis by creating a housing bubble.
Mm-hmm.
The recession's a correction for this. And then when government compounds the error by trying to stand in the way of the correction, when the government says, well, we're not going to allow markets to correct, we're going to try to regulate even more, this prevents markets from regaining the solid footing that they need.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned Tom Woods' great book, which really focuses on the recent, that book being called Meltdown, and our interview which we did with him on Radio Free Market. But you also had mentioned Bob Murphy's book.
Yes, Politically Correct, Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression. And Murphy does a tremendous job. I recommend it to high school history teachers and college professors who are trying to address this in a way that is not giving in to the normal myths about the Great Depression.
Well, this is an unprecedented moment on our show, but this is the first time I've plugged our previous shows twice in one show. But I'd like all the listeners to know that in our archives we also have an interview with Dr. Bob Murphy on his great book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. And I highly recommend that everyone download that. And, of course, as I always like to say, all of our shows for free, or you can also subscribe on iTunes and have them automatically sent to you. So let's talk just a little bit more about here that how the recessions are a cleansing mechanism for the market.
Yes. If you look at what happens when the government tries to artificially reduce interest rates, when the Fed is pumping out money, trying to force those interest rates down below where they should be, businesses start to make mistakes. They start to invest in projects that look profitable with the lower interest rates. But eventually that has to come to an end. You eventually face a choice between hyperinflation or a recession of some kind that purges those bad investments from the system. So the recession is really a process of reallocating resources from the projects that now people understand never would have worked with normal interest rates. But when those interest rates start to go back up, those resources start to go to where they should have been all along. Now, some businesses are in trouble during this recession. Other businesses will gain those resources, and they will do relatively well. But I've compared this to going through some sort of recreational drug withdrawal. You face this choice of either damaging yourself further with the drug use or going through this painful process of withdrawal. It has to happen at some point. The more you postpone it, the more you try to create money and keep those interest rates down, the worse it's going to be when the recession finally occurs.
And it eventually will occur if it's artificially induced on the upside.
Of course it will be.
And this is why Doug French likes to say that the real problem is the boom, not the bust.
Yes.
And understanding how the boom is created. So, folks, we're coming into the end of this particular segment, and we'll be back after our break. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. And we're talking with Dr. Timothy Terrell on the 10 Common Objections to Capitalism. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Timothy Terrell, and we're discussing the 10 common objections to capitalism, and we're on number 9 now. This is that capitalism puts products ahead of people. Please respond to that.
Yes, well, there's this common objection that companies are only after profit. They're not putting people's priorities first, and you have a certain number of cases that constantly come up in business ethics classes, and one common one is the Ford Pinto case, where Ford made a car that turned out if it was hit in a rear-end collision, it would burst into flame. And in the court case, it was discovered that if Ford had simply put an $11 improvement into the car, they could have avoided this. And it was as though Ford were trying to kill their customers. This is not generally a good business practice.
No, not for a car company.
Certainly not, no. And in hindsight, with all the bad publicity, I'm sure they would have made different choices. But it's not a problem for a firm to have to think about the costs and benefits of improving quality. There's no such dichotomy between a safe product and an unsafe product. It's a spectrum. You can have more safety or less.
That's a beautiful statement. It's a spectrum, not a two separate boxes.
Yes.
You know, we don't get to choose the safe box or the unsafe box.
Right.
There's a spectrum upon which we have to choose where we're going to be.
That's right. And to assume that government regulation is going to produce the right amount of safety for everyone, I think, is a fallacy.
I love how you say the capitalist satisfies a consumer's complex personal set of priorities. That's really great.
Yes, there's so many dimensions to any product that people are looking for. And the entrepreneur has to look at what consumers want, try to predict what they will want in the future, and try to satisfy that as well as they can. Some consumers may want a more safe car. Some people may want more fuel economy. Some people may want more performance.
Obviously, a smaller, thinner shelled car obviously doesn't have the same protection power as a bigger, heavier, thicker car.
And one of the ironies of this is that we have another government regulation that's creating less safe cars, the corporate average fuel economy requirement.
Okay. So let's go on to objection number 10, and that is capitalism leads to the production of objectionable goods and services, and I almost tripped on that, objectionable goods and services. And my question is, who says?
Right. It's either going to be the government telling you what you can and can't do with your person, with your property, or it's going to be the individual. And my priority, I tend to have a rather strong idea about morality, and there are certain things that I approve of and don't approve of. But the key is that when I'm trying to perpetuate my idea of morality, I use persuasion.
Right.
I don't want to force other people to comply. I would much rather see them agree with me. And so I'm a professor partly because I want to seek agreement and understanding.
I think you also use example, your own life. You know, you demonstrate by living a peaceful life that it works.
Yes.
And so persuasion, example, the demonstration of it, I think is education, an excellent thing.
That's certainly what I do with my own children. I can't expect them to continue along the lines that I approve of unless they are agreeing with me. That's my tactic.
So what is it that we can't do in order to really affect a change?
Using aggression against someone else to deprive them of their property or their freedom, I think, is one of the most objectionable things that we can do.
And I would agree with you. And on that particular note, I'm going to thank you, Dr. Timothy Terrell, for being with us today. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.